be made invalid following an opposition campaign for people to write anti-government slogans on money. The bank said people possessing defaced notes should exchange them by January the 8th. The former Venezuelan president, Rafael Caldera, has died at the age of 93. Mr. Caldera initially became president in 1969, the first time Venezuela had seen a peaceful transfer of power between political parties. After a second term of office, Rafael Caldera was succeeded in office by Hugo Chavez, a former army colonel he had released from jail and pardoned for staging an unsuccessful coup attempt. President John Atta Mills of Ghana is refusing to accept Christmas presents from well-wishers because he says they may be intended to corrupt him. Sending gifts to people in authority is a Christmas tradition in Ghana. But President Mills, who has pledged to cut down on corruption, said he felt it was better not to accept them. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall and this is Europe Today. And the United States today moved closer to a European model of universal health care with the passage of a bill through the US Senate. There was a majority vote in favour of one of President Obama's key domestic policies, the extension of health care to more than 30 million uninsured Americans. The bill requires every US citizen to have health insurance or pay a special tax. Republicans are bitterly opposed to the reforms, and that acrimony is expected to persist as the Senate bill is merged with one already passed by the House of Representatives. That has to happen before President Obama can sign the reforms into law in the new year. The Vice President Joe Biden presided over the Senate vote.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 39, H.R. 3590 as amended, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is passed.
The yes vote by Christmas had become a priority for President Obama, who said the importance of the bill could not be underestimated.
With today's vote, we are now incredibly close to making health insurance reform a reality in this country. Our challenge then is to finish the job. We can't doom another generation of Americans to soaring costs and eroding coverage and exploding deficits. Instead, we need to do what we were sent here to do and improve the lives of the people we serve. For the sake of our citizens, our economy, and our future, let's make 2010 the year we finally reform health care in the United States of America.
But speaking shortly before the vote, the Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell said the bill was full of compromises and there was still strong opposition to it.
I guarantee you that people who voted for this bill are going to get an earful when they finally get home for the first time since Thanksgiving. They know there is widespread opposition to this monstrosity. And I want to assure you, Mr. President, this fight isn't over. In fact, this fight is long from over. My colleagues and I will work to stop this bill from becoming law. That's the clear will of the American people, and we're going to continue to fight on their behalf.
Senator McConnell, I've been speaking to U.S. Congressman Dennis Kucinich about the Senate vote. Although a Democrat, he's a critic of the health care reforms because he believes they will still leave the insurance companies with too much power. He advocates instead more of the public option, that's to say, a government scheme to compete with private insurers. Despite those misgivings, is Mr. Kucinich pleased that the Senate has passed the bill?
It's a political achievement for President Obama, no question about it. But I think that we need some deeper analysis here. What actually it's going to do to the people who are going to be forced to buy private insurance. Remember, a lot of people didn't have private insurance because they couldn't afford it. And just being mandated to buy it with a small government subsidy doesn't really establish that people will be able to afford the insurance they're going to get or if they're going to have watered-down benefits.
So you disagree with the projections that this bill will bring health insurance to more than 30 million Americans who didn't have it before?
Well, I reject the underlying assumption that it's okay to subsidize private insurance companies in order to try to get more people coverage, because insurance companies make money not providing health care. They're not charitable organizations. and the government's going to be left with increasing subsidies, while the quality of care is sure to decline because the insurance companies are not going to run up costs suddenly caring for people. I mean, Wall Street responded very positively to the news that the Senate had the bill moving. They recognize that this is a windfall for the insurance industry because you've got 30 million people who are forced to buy private insurance, $50 billion in new annual revenue for the insurance companies, and they're not, they repeat, they will not suddenly open up their coffers to take care of the additional people. They'll do the minimum. They'll look for loopholes that are plenty in the bill to double charges for people who fail wellness tests, to charge four times more based on age and for pre-existing conditions. I mean, anybody who reads the bill knows that it's really wide open for cash for the insurance industry and pharmaceutical industry, but the help for the people is really speculative at this moment.
But realistically, Congressman, isn't this the best that President Obama could have hoped for politically?
With interest groups having such a powerful hold on our political system, one could say, well, the best we could do is force you to buy private insurance and pay a premium for it and not have any controls over those premiums in the future, which have, by the way, gone up four times in the last 4 years. It really is a commentary on our system. We do have a problem with people not having health care. But this is really aimed at insurance reform and doesn't provide any competition for insurance companies. It continues to exempt insurance companies from antitrust laws, lets them keep a monopoly, and no regulation on premiums. And while it is a political victory for President Obama, we have to give him that, the underlying economic analysis will not stand the test of credibility when you understand there'll still be many Americans who will not be able to afford the mandate that will be imposed on them if this bill finally becomes law.
But given what you say, why was there so much opposition to the bill from health insurance companies, well, from Republicans?
Smokescreen. I mean, maybe some sincere people didn't realize that they were being played. But this is a smokescreen by the insurance companies saying, oh, no, we don't want that. The insurance companies knew that if they could get the bill that is now in its form coming out of the Senate, that they were going to be reaping huge profits as a result. And that's what they want. They got what they want. Even if they said they didn't want it, that's for public consumption. But when you go to Wall Street, that's the test. You know, look where the smart money is. The smart money now is on health insurance stocks. So you have to discount sharply the insurance industry's protestations. They protest too much. They protest all the way to the bank.
U.S. Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and I'm joined now from Washington by the BBC's Imtiaz Taib. Imtiaz, we heard there what I suppose is a critique of the healthcare reforms from the left wing of the Democratic Party, but do all Democrats have such reservations?
No, absolutely not. There are many Democrats here who are very pleased that this sort of reform has happened. Keep in mind, the House Majority Leader, Harry Reid, who crafted this bill, is widely being applauded here in the United States, just from political terms, for being able to craft a bill and to negotiate within the Democratic Party. Because keep in mind, the Democratic Party does have its own extremes. There are those who are the very liberal end of the spectrum, and there are those who are on the quite conservative side of the spectrum. And his challenge was to bring both of those sides together. And so the Democrats, many of the moderate Democrats, which are the majority, people who sort of sit in the middle of both these extremes, are quite pleased that healthcare reform has got this far. Not everybody, of course, is happy. Many wanted a very robust public option, a government-run plan that would compete with private insurers. That, of course, is not in the Senate version, but it is in the version passed by the House of Representatives on November the 7th. So while there's not a lot of hope that this public option will become law when these two bills start to become reconciled, there's still very many Democrats who are quite pleased with what's happened today.
Just explain to me how that works, Imtiaz, the reconciliation of these two bits of legislation.
It's an interesting process, the way it works. Basically, the way lawmaking works in the United States, the way it's designed, rather, is in order to make it quite difficult to pass laws, which is why you have to have the lower house, which is Congress, have to pass this bill, the House of Representatives, which, of course, we saw on November 7th. And only then can it be brought up to the Senate. And, of course, in the Senate, we've seen 24 days of consecutive voting up until today, where this bill has been passed. And even then, although these two groups of elected lawmakers have agreed to pass a bill, it still doesn't become law because then both these sides need to be married together. Now, the reconciliation process, rather, essentially involves Democrats and Republicans to form committees, to form groups where they basically come together with both of these bills and try to marry them together. Now, perhaps what's most interesting about what's going to happen in the next coming days is that, or rather over the next coming weeks, particularly in January, is President Obama has pledged that, and I quote, he's going to roll up his sleeves and be very much a part of this process. As we know, he hasn't been very much a part of the bill writing process. He wasn't a big part of the vote that cleared the House of Representatives. He certainly wasn't a huge part of what we've just seen today in the Senate. But now we have the president saying, I am taking part.
And very, very briefly, Imtiaz, is there still a possibility that the Republicans could prevent this legislation being signed into law?
They will most certainly be doing everything possible to ensure that this reconciliation process does fall apart. But what the Democrats are saying is this reform, whatever it looks like, has simply gone too far, and they're not going to walk away from the table until the job is done.
Imtiaz, many thanks. That's the BBC's Imtiaz Tayeb in Washington. So can he do it? Can President Obama fulfill his promise to overhaul healthcare in the United States in 2010? Let us know. What do you think? Our email address, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com, or you can text us on 4477 8620 6080. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Europe Today. It's coming up to 1717 GMT. A reminder of the latest international news headlines. American senators have voted to approve ambitious plans for US healthcare reform, the centerpiece of President Obama's domestic agenda. Yemen says it's attacked and killed a group of al-Qaeda militants as they gathered for a secret meeting. Bomb explosions in the Iraqi cities of Hilla and Baghdad have killed at least 23 people and wounded more than 100. And Georgia is to reopen its land border with Russia despite continuing tension over Moscow's support for Georgian separatists. Well, as we've just heard, bomb attacks in the Iraqi cities of Baghdad and Hilla have killed at least 23 people. Many of those killed are thought to have been taking part in Shia religious gatherings. The annual commemoration of Ashura falls this Sunday. Iraq's dwindling Christian community also has cause to fear as they prepare to celebrate Christmas. Yesterday, a bomb targeted an historic church in the northern city of Mosul, leaving two people dead. And today, a Christian minibus driver in the city was killed by unknown gunmen. The Iraqi government says the army will be on high alert over Christmas. The defense ministry says it's received intelligence indicating a possible attack. According to some estimates, half of Iraq's Christians have left their homes since the US-led invasion in 2003. Rob Walker reports from Baghdad.
I've come now to the Church of the Virgin Mary, which is in the northeast of Baghdad. And as you can hear, right opposite the church on the other side of the street is a mosque. And just going inside the church now, it has beautiful wooden carved doors. This hymn is being sung in the ancient language of Aramaic. Christians have lived and worshipped in Iraq for centuries, but some among this congregation are worried about the future.
I am Monsignor Solomon Werdouni, auxiliary bishop.
What's the situation now of your congregation here?
When I came here 11 years ago, I met more than 850 families, but now I think they are maybe less than half because of the situation. No security. Always we pray to be better.
There are some signs things are getting better in Baghdad. The stalls along this street are selling Christmas decorations in a way that wouldn't have been possible a few years ago. And you can buy everything here, from plastic Christmas trees to inflatable Father Christmases. And there's a couple of women up here who are doing their Christmas shopping. Let's have a quick word with them.
شجرة مع الميلاد بالمناسبة واشترينا غراض زينة مالتها.
We are trying to buy a Christmas tree as well as some other stuff that can be added to the tree.
And I can see you've got in your bag some decorations. Little plastic Father Christmas there.
We celebrate just like the Christians.
So you're both Muslims, but you're buying decorations for Christmas.
Well, you know, this occasion is not only for Christians, they are for Muslims as well.
Many Christians have left Iraq since 2003. Do you hope that they will start to come back?
Well, yeah, we hope that they come back because this is their country. It's for the Christians and for the Muslims, so they should come back.
Well, thank you very much. Merry Christmas.
Shukran jazilan.
So I'll leave those two ladies to carry on with their shopping. Baghdad is, of course, still a dangerous place, but some of the Christians who fled their homes during the worst of the violence have now returned. And I'm heading off to meet a Christian family who've come back from America.
My name is Intisar Shawkat Georges. Life was difficult in America. We were homesick. We missed everything about Iraq. We missed the soil and the trees, the people and their kindness, and we missed our neighbors.
Your neighbors are Christians, or Christians and Muslims, a mix?
Christians and Muslims, but most are Muslims. When I came back, they took me by the arms and said they'd missed me.
I've come to a park right next to the Tigris River in the center of Baghdad, and it's a very peaceful scene. There's a group of young men playing football over there and a few children playing on the slide and on the swings. Now, while some Christians are back in their homes for the first time this Christmas, others are actually preparing to leave Iraq. I'm here with Leila Paulos and her son Siva, who's 13. And in 2 weeks' time, they're heading off to Sweden. Leila, can you tell me, why have you decided to leave Iraq?
Life in Iraq is difficult. My son was kidnapped. He went to the shop one day to buy something and didn't come back. We paid a ransom for his release. So out of fear, we decided to leave the country. It's sad to leave Iraq, of course. It's the country of our ancestors, but there's nothing we can do. Most of the Christians who live in our neighborhood have already gone. We're the only ones left.
Of course, it's not just Christians who face threats here. Other Iraqis are also afraid of the kidnappings and the bombings. The future of Iraq's Christians is tied to the rest of Iraq's population, and that is still uncertain.
Rob Walker reporting from Baghdad. Time now for My Year, our series where we've invited people to look back at their role in one of the year's big news stories. There's a corporate high flyer brought down by the recession, a leading climate change activist and the youngest ever around the world yachtsman. But we start today with a Somali pirate who calls himself Hassan. Hassan decided to speak to us in the pirate stronghold of Haradari in central Somalia to explain why he and some of his companions decided to turn to piracy as a way of making a living.
I haven't succeeded in taking anything this year, but I did hijack a ship the year before. I have invested all the money I've made from piracy very wisely indeed. My life is much better now than it was when I was a fisherman. I have a wife, only one, mind you, and some children. My life has changed in a very big way. I do not want to go into the details, but I can tell you clearly that my life is much better now. I went to sea 2 or 3 times this year, but I didn't bump into any warships. Some of my colleagues did. They had their guns confiscated even before they had done anything wrong, but they were released. Others were caught and arrested. It can go both ways.
Good morning. The captain taken hostage by Somali pirates has thanked his rescuers after he was dramatically freed unharmed last night.
Snipers from the US Navy killed 3 of his captors and a 4th was taken into custody.
The pirates have disrupted major shipping lanes and are holding close to 200 people to ransom.
This year has been completely normal. Nothing especially bad has happened to me. You know, I used to be a fisherman, but foreign fishing boats came to our waters and stole all our fish. When they did that to us, we decided to hunt them down, and we are now reaping the benefits. We've done really well out of those foreigners who disturbed our business. We are now profiting from our decision to turn on them. These foreign fishermen have now brought foreign navies to Somali waters, and they are continuing to fish by sending out their trawlers behind the warships. They have even mounted guns onto some of their fishing boats. Whenever we try to fish, they start shooting at us. So we have decided to turn those foreigners into our fish, and we are now fishing for them. All of us pirates have gained financially from this. I can tell you that my financial situation is very good.
The latest weapon in the fight against piracy. No windows and no crew, but this American drone does have an all-seeing eye. Controlled remotely, it heads off from the Seychelles to fly over the Indian Ocean. Its mission, to locate, track and film pirates.
The sea is a very dangerous place, so everybody gets frightened. I cannot predict what is going to happen next year. That is up to God. I will change my career if those foreigners stop fishing in our waters and dumping toxic waste there. I have seen a lot of places where they have dumped containers full of poison. People who live in those areas have had to move because they are terrified of the poison, which is everywhere. A few years ago, there were more than 700 foreign trawlers stealing fish from Somali waters. Now there are no fish to be found. They have left us with nothing. The only people doing well from fishing now are us pirates, because we are fishing for hostages.
This was Captain Phillips soon after his rescue, safe at last on a U.S. warship.
Thanks, guys. Yep. Thank you very much.
He's said to be unharmed, in good health, his sense of humor still intact. For 5 days, he'd been held hostage in an enclosed lifeboat. The boat had been taken in tow by the USS Bainbridge. One pirate had come aboard to negotiate.
I'm not happy with being a pirate at all. If I carry on like this, I could end up in terrible danger. For now, I'm using my old equipment, but next year, if circumstances allow, I will try and buy new equipment. That might help me capture more foreigners who steal our fish and poison our waters. I will ask the hostages to pay me a lot of ransom money. The exact amount will depend on how the negotiations go. If those foreigners leave our seas and my country settles down, I will stop this life. I don't want to make piracy my profession. All of us want to return to our lives as fishermen. I have become a pirate for political reasons. I use the money I've made from piracy to develop my country. If we get a government that can manage the affairs of Somalia, I will stop this piracy business.
A Somali pirate who goes by the name of Hassan, with the first of our series looking back at 2009 called My Year. Tomorrow we'll be hearing from a New Yorker who lost her job in the global financial crisis and how she coped with that sudden change in her fortunes. You're listening to Europe Today. It's coming up to 17:29 GMT. Stay with us for a summary of world news.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International. Distribution is made possible in part by the Medtronic Foundation, working with Teach for America to improve science and math education in communities across the United States. Information available at medtronicfoundation.org.
Our fiscal year is almost halfway over, and we should be halfway to an especially important annual listener support goal, given a recent cut in state funding. We are within $150,000, and your tax-deductible gift of $50, $100, or $500 will keep us on track. Give at willpledge.org, or mail a check to UIF, Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801. Thanks.
You're listening to the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. This is Europe Today. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia's relations with the West. A top Russian parliamentarian tells us Moscow will give more help in Afghanistan, but on its own terms. A best-selling Italian author on how downshifting his life has brought him so much success. And live to Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, how long will the shepherds be able to watch their flocks? But first, a summary of the latest news.
BBC News with Roy Lama. The US Senate has voted in favor of one of President Obama's key domestic policies, the extension of health care cover to nearly all Americans. To become law, the bill will now have to be reconciled with one previously passed by the House of Representatives. Speaking after the vote, Mr. Obama said it was the most important piece of US social legislation since the 1930s. The authorities in Yemen say their forces have killed more than 30 al-Qaeda militants in an air raid in the eastern province of Shabwa. Officials say that the militants were holding a meeting to plan attacks on Yemeni and foreign oil targets. Bomb attacks in Iraq have killed at least 23 people and wounded many others. Two near simultaneous explosions at a crowded bus station in Hilla, south of Baghdad, killed at least 15 people and wounded 70. The second bomb detonated as police were trying to defuse it. In Baghdad, at least 8 people were killed by 2 bombs, one in the mainly Shia district of Sadr City and the other targeting Shia pilgrims in the east of the city. Georgia says it has agreed with Russia to reopen their joint land border. The Georgian deputy foreign minister said she expected it to reopen by the beginning of March. It was closed in 2006 amid tensions over Georgia's efforts to build closer ties with the West. The Chinese judicial authorities have imposed the death penalty on another 5 people for their part in bloody ethnic riots earlier this year in the western region of Xinjiang. It brings to at least 22 the number of people sentenced to death in connection with the violence. President John Atta Mills of Ghana is refusing to accept Christmas presents from well-wishers this year because he says they may be intended to corrupt him. His spokesman said it was better not to accept traditional gifts, such as hampers of food, as the givers might be seeking something in return. BBC World News.
BBC World Service, this is Europe Today. And this year has seen a slight improvement in relations between the United States and Russia. President Obama has spoken of his desire to press the reset button. And in a year-end TV interview, President Medvedev has described his relations with Mr. Obama as trustworthy. In the same interview, Mr. Medvedev also said that the two countries were close to a new strategic arms reduction agreement, but that Russia would continue to work on a new generation of nuclear missiles to ensure its nuclear deterrent remains effective.
Мы, конечно, будем заниматься развитием новых систем.
Of course, we will develop new systems, including platforms or missiles. This is routine practice. The entire world is doing it. Naturally, it should be done within the frameworks of conventions, taking into account our future agreements with the Americans, among other factors. But this process will continue, and our nuclear deterrent will always be effective and sufficient to defend our national interests.
But Russia's policy of defending its national interests continues to make it an awkward partner for the West. Its relationship with its closest neighbours, such as Georgia and Ukraine, are still unstable, and serious questions remain about Russia's human rights record. The recent death in prison of the lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, who was working for a Western investment fund which had fallen foul of the Kremlin, reinforced the impression of a country where opposition figures and journalists who question authority are in danger of their lives. James Kumarasamy has been speaking to the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Russian Parliament, Konstantin Kosachev. He began by asking him about Russia's current policy in Afghanistan.
We are absolutely interested in having this operation as a success story.
our interests with the United States, with United Kingdom, other NATO countries, in this sense, coincide 100%, because Russia is affected by what is going on in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, the current format of the peace enforcement or peacekeeping cooperation there is a NATO format. It's not good. And this is why we are so much concerned about NATO enlargement as a major security project, global security project, because NATO does have its natural limits, and we see it in Afghanistan. This is why.
But you have common. You say you have common interests. You have a common. You face a common threat. Can't you work together?
We work together. We work together, and we provide possibilities for both civil and military transit through Russian territory. We have exchange of intelligence data and things like that, but we do not participate in this operation directly, because it is just impossible for any politician in Russia and for any military commander in Russia to send officers and soldiers with us not being able to participate in a decision-making process.
How successful have the Americans been in doing what they said they were setting out to do, to reset the button with Russia?
Well, we are not in the end of this process, but I think that it does bring positive results. We have much better confidence and trust in our bilateral relations, and I believe that the military transit to Afghanistan through Russia is a very concrete result of that reset button being pushed down, and we have a completely different dialogue on Iran.
Iran, is Russia now ready to apply sanctions if they were needed?
It depends on the conclusions made by IAEA. We try to stick ourselves to the provisions of the international law. And we know how it all developed in Iraq the previous time, and we want to avoid mistakes made by the United States and by the United Kingdom that time.
You're head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Duma, so you deal a lot with foreign countries. To what extent are the criticisms that Russia faces over human rights record, over the killings of unsolved murders of journalists, how much does that damage Russia's image in the rest of the world, do you think?
It does damage Russia's image, definitely. This is a huge problem. And in many cases, we are responsible for that. In many other cases, I believe that there is a prejudice against...
You say you are responsible in some cases. Does that mean you don't think Russia's doing enough to solve these unsolved murders?
In some cases, we should concentrate on that much more. But, you know, the assassination of the Prime Minister of Sweden, Olof Palme, is still unresolved. So in some cases, when we have to do with organized crime, it is very difficult to learn the truth immediately. But again, in some cases...
That case didn't damage the image of Sweden and the rest of the world in the same way that these unsolved cases have damaged Russia's
but
image.
Yes, but Russia is not Sweden. We are in a transition period. We do have problems with our democratic development. We do have problems with freedom of speech. We do have problems with safety of human rights defenders. What is wrong with the perception existing here in the United Kingdom, for example, is that the state, the Russian state, is responsible for these killings, is responsible for the problems in the mass media sector, and so on and so forth. Sometimes it's about completely different things, and sometimes some things are being made, I am absolutely convinced about that, deliberately in order to damage the democratic image of Russia.
That was Konstantin Kosachev, who's the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Russian Parliament. The North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, is as intimidating as it sounds. It was created 50 years ago to track incoming missile strikes. But in the past half century, it's also developed an interesting sideline that really comes into its own at this time of the year. It's trained its radars and satellites on Santa Claus, tracking his progress through the night skies. Over the years, millions of children have phoned NORAD to find out where Santa is, and this being the 21st century, Santa's festive forays can now be followed on Twitter and Facebook. He can also be tracked on NORAD's website using Google Earth. Here's the update from the start of Christmas Eve.
And it's liftoff. NORAD satellites are picking up heat signatures from Rudolph's bright red nose. Santa and his nine reindeer are full of energy and are ready for the long haul ahead. From the North Pole, we suspect from years past that he'll fly down into the Pacific Ocean, to the coast of Russia, through the Bering Strait, headed south to the Marshall Islands. Even loaded with all the gifts and goodies, Santa's sleigh seems to be moving fast. Stay tuned at NORADSanta.org as we continue to track Santa on his Yuletide journey. For NORAD Track Santa, I'm Tech Sergeant Lucas Bullen.
And on the line now from the Santa Tracking Operations Center in Colorado, Lieutenant Commander Gary Ross. And the question has to be, where exactly is Santa now?
Well, right now we hold him in Tajikistan, and it appears that he's heading over to Mount Everest in Nepal.
Is he difficult to track? I mean, does he year by year tend to follow the same path?
Well, I think generally speaking, yes, because, you know, he needs to start off in the Eastern Hemisphere, that being where Japan and Australia are, because that's the that's actually where the day begins after right after the international dateline. So he moves throughout Southeast Asia, up into Russia, and then into Central Asia, where he is right now.
So fairly predictable, but what about speeds? I mean, do you find it difficult sometimes to sort of pick him up on your cameras?
We do. He travels very fast, his technology is such that, you know, we're still trying to figure that out, and, you know, if there's any way that we could, you know, find that out, it would be a great thing for the military, wouldn't it?
So if children want to find out at any given time where Santa is, they can go to your website, but they can also give you a call, is that right?
That's right. We have our website at www.noradsanta.org, or they can call one of our NORAD Track Santa volunteers here in the NORAD Track Santa Operations Center at 1-877-HI-NORAD.
Okay, but I suppose they better ask their parents first. Lieutenant Commander Gary Ross, many thanks. Speaking there from the Santa Tracking Operations Center in Colorado. Now, there are hundreds of mothers around the world who've been able to have a baby because a total stranger donated his sperm. But could sperm donors be more reluctant to come forward in the coming years? Many European countries now have laws allowing people who were conceived with donor sperm to identify not only their biological father, but any half-siblings they might have. And that end to the anonymity that sperm donors enjoyed may mean that in future there are fewer of them. Denmark is one country where sperm donors can still remain anonymous, and it's also home to the world's biggest sperm bank. Ellen Otzen reports from Copenhagen.
A nitrogen tank full of donor semen being opened. The Danish sperm bank Krios exports sperm all over the world under the slogan, "Congratulations, it's a Viking." The wide availability of anonymous donor sperm in Denmark has sparked a surge in a new type of tourism, women travelling there in the hope of conceiving a child. Fewer countries allow anonymity for sperm donors. It stopped in the UK in 2005, and without anonymity, the demand for donor sperm has completely outstripped supply, leading to a boom in business for many Danish fertility clinics. I went to one of the clinics in the capital, Copenhagen, the aptly named Stork Clinic, to meet midwife Nina Stork.
We had an increasing number of women coming to us. From 2005, the British women started to come, and then we had a peak in 2007 that has almost kept on since.
What reasons are you hearing from the British women when they come here?
Lack of donor semen is the main reason. Most of them are single women, and then lesbian women, and a very few heterosexual couples. The average age of single women is about 38, 39.
In 2007, Denmark liberalised its laws on sperm donation, making artificial insemination combined with IVF legal for single women. One of the women who followed this course of treatment is Abby, a London lawyer who doesn't want to use her real name. Abby had wanted to have a child of her own for years. When she found herself still single at 41, she decided to try for insemination with donor sperm. After three unsuccessful attempts at her local hospital, she was told there was no more sperm left. She then contacted a Danish sperm bank.
I spoke to an extremely helpful woman, and then discussing it with her further, she
said to me, well, why don't you just come to Denmark? Which is what I decided to do. So after 6 or 7 weeks of treatment, I went over to Denmark. I had a pregnancy test 2 weeks later, and it was positive. I had my little boy, and he's gorgeous. He's absolutely amazing. A bit of a miracle baby, has to be said.
It's unlikely that Denmark will change its laws, and because of this, its sperm banks are thriving. There's no shortage of donors, like Jonas, a 24-year-old science student.
I'm doing it at the most clinical way. I don't want anything to do with the children that grow up. I want to find their father. I'm doing it for the money and to get a medical check a couple of times a year.
10 years ago, waiting lists for insemination with donor sperm in the UK didn't really exist. But now, most clinics have a waiting list of at least 2 years. Several other European countries have adopted the same policy as the UK. Norway, Sweden, Finland, Holland, Austria and Switzerland have all ended donor anonymity. Because of the long waiting lists in these countries, many women end up travelling to Denmark. Midwife Sophie Bugge works at a popular fertility clinic in Copenhagen.
Most of the women come from Germany, but we also have a lot of women from Sweden and Norway and Italy and Britain. We also have from the other countries in Europe and even from a few countries outside of Europe.
Midwife Sophie Bugger ending that report from Ellen Otson. Romania this week saw the swearing-in of a new president and will see the 20th anniversary of the execution of a former head of state. President Traian Băsescu takes over at a time of deepening economic recession in Romania, which his government has pledged to reverse. During his inauguration speech, he also referred to the more than 1,100 people who died in the 1989 revolution, which brought down Nicolae Ceaușescu. He and his wife were sentenced to death in a trial lasting a single day on December the 25th, 1989, and shot by a firing squad. But the trial shed no light on the 45 years of his brutal regime, and many of the victims are still waiting to tell their story in court. My colleague Dan Damon has been speaking to President Basescu's predecessor, Ion Iliescu, who led the transition to democracy. He asked him for his first memory of the revolution.
First of all, I could underline that all of us,
have passed through a very important moment of our history, not only our national history, but also the history of Europe, because 1989 was such a tremendous process for this part of Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, that changed in general the face of our society, not only of our country, but of Europe and its peoples, a tremendous moment in contemporary history. European relations and goals changed completely. It was the end of the Cold War and the consolidation of the peace and the opening of a process of our integration into Europe. So we consider 1989 to be a real revolution, in spite of the fact that we didn't have the chance to have a peaceful transition from the dictatorship to democracy like other countries in our area, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria. We were obliged, because of the oppressive system of Ceaușescu, to be part of a popular revolt, which cost a lot of lives among our people. But our revolution had a very radical and popular character because it was done by the Romanian people.
Well, that, sir, if I may say, that is still in some, that's still in some doubt, isn't it? I was in Bucharest 20 years ago, and you could find people then, and certainly since then, who said this wasn't a people's revolution, it was a military coup. It may have been necessary because of the terrible dictatorship of Nicolae and Elena Ceaușescu, but it was organized in advance by military units.
No, it is false.
There's been speculation that there was a chance it could have been done by a coup d'etat by the military or the political forces. There was a sort of coup d'etat in Bulgaria, for instance, where the Central Committee decided to remove their leader, Todor Zhivkov. By doing so, they facilitated a peaceful process. With Romania, it wasn't possible, not by civic forces. And the members of the Central Committee remained solid around Ceaușescu until the last moment. Nobody from the army thought about removing him. On the contrary, they were ordered by Ceaușescu to suppress the people's revolt in Timișoara and then in Bucharest. So we didn't have a chance of a military coup d'etat. It was a real popular revolt generated by the oppressive system. And at first, the army took measures to repress the people doing it in Timișoara and Bucharest. But on the 13th of December in Timișoara, all the population and mainly the workers from the industrial enterprises, and then in Bucharest on the 22nd, rose up en masse, and the army was obliged to stop the repression and even to support the people's revolt.
But you had been preparing, you must have been preparing for such an eventuality, because the National Salvation Front that you led was organized very, very quickly. By the evening of the 22nd, the morning of the 23rd, there were people all over Romania who were answerable to you.
But it was done, it was organized in the night.
It was organized in the night of the 22nd, as you correctly underline. But it was the idea of the people who united themselves. There was a diversion of a terrorist character which had started in the afternoon and which was created by the people loyal to Ceausescu to try to stop the organization of a new form of power. So our national salvation appeared in very difficult conditions generated by this terrorist dimension on the 22nd after the removal of Ceausescu.
Was it necessary to execute Nicolae and Elena Ceausescu in that cold-blooded way that was done?
It was a necessity because the army didn't have the possibility to stop.
It was a necessity because the army didn't have the capacity to stop the activity of the terrorist group. Nobody knew who these people were. They acted during the night and many people died. On the 24th, a trial was organized. It was largely improvised. But it was a correct decision, because the next day, after the trial and the execution, all these army diversions stopped, as they were linked to the existence of Ceausescu and the activity of this loyal group who tried to stop the organization of the new structures of the new power.
Do you regret, nonetheless, the way that that execution was carried out?
Of course, it should be from the political
Of course, from the political point of view, it would have been preferable to organize a political trial. But we were in circumstances where people were dying every hour. And from this point of view, the activities of the diversionary group stopped immediately after the trial and the execution of Ceausescu.
Are the people of Romania, are they celebrating this anniversary today or regretting what might have been? Because life is still tough for so many Romanians.
The Romanian society is split now.
Unfortunately, Romanian society is split now. A lot of people are not satisfied with all of the evolution of social society. After the revolution, a lot of people suffered from the economic and social point of view. Many of the industrial workers from Timișoara and Bucharest were the big social force of the revolution. Then they lost their jobs. But nobody should prefer now to enter into a new Ceausescu era, to enter into a new form of dictatorship or authoritarian regime, because the main achievement of the revolution was liberty, liberty of thinking, liberty of expression, of organization, of political pluralism, free elections and so on. People appreciated these real achievements. But from the economic and social point of view, there are a lot of reasons for dissatisfaction.
The former Romanian President Ioan Iliescu, and we voiced over his answers because of the poor quality of the telephone line. And we go now to the West Bank town of Bethlehem, the biblical birthplace of Jesus, which each Christmas becomes a place of pilgrimage for thousands of Christians from around the world. They're gathering now for the traditional Christmas Eve religious service in Bethlehem's Manger Square. But amidst the celebrations, reality intrudes in the form of the Israeli-built barrier that runs alongside three sides of the town. From Bethlehem, I'm joined by Bethany Bell. Bethany, tourist numbers tend to fluctuate depending on the levels of violence in the region. What are the numbers this year?
Well, the authorities say that it's a good year for tourists, but what the Palestinian officials are still concerned about is that many of the tourists who come to Bethlehem come just for a few hours. They come on tour trips. They don't stay overnight as much as the officials here would like, which means that they don't go into the shops and restaurants and keep the town buzzing that way. Tonight, however, it's a different story. People say that the hotels are booked out tonight pretty much, and that and in the whole of the square at the moment, lots and lots of people have gathered. There's a concert going on. In fact, just trooping up onto the stage now are a group of choir of people dressed up in long white robes, a little bit like angels, which I think is the idea that they're trying to put across, and they're about to sing Christmas carols.
And a few hours before the actual religious service gets underway.
Yes, yes. In a little while, at midnight local time, a mass will be held in the ancient Church of the Nativity, which is where the traditional site, according to Christian belief, of Jesus Christ. Now, some of the first people, according to the biblical account, to visit Jesus Christ after he was born were shepherds. Now, they're still shepherds living in the hills of the West Bank, very close to here, in very similar conditions. Some of them live in caves. But now the United Nations has said that their lives are coming under threat. A flock of sheep and some scrawny goats huddle in a rough stone enclosure on this barren hillside. They belong to Muhammad Abu Ali and his wife Fatima, who live in a cave next to the sheep pen. Fatima says the animals are all they have.
They give us a rough time, but they are good when we are desperate for money. They have to be well looked after. They have to be vaccinated, but at the end of the day, they support our life.
Looking out into the hills and mountains, the very south of the West Bank. Now, after the rains, this would be green here, but at the moment it's dry and barren, with nothing for the animals to eat. Muhammad says his ancestors have herded here for centuries, but now times are hard. There's been a drought for several years. Muhammad and his family live in an area of the West Bank that's under Israeli control. He says it's almost impossible to get permission to build new wells.
Everything is forbidden, especially involving concrete. To build a new well is not allowed. There are wells here, but they are small and the water is not enough. We also get harassment from the settlers when we move with our animals.
The Israeli civil administration says it isn't aware of requests to build wells in the area, but that it's ready to consider people's problems. At a village nearby, sheep jostle to reach the metal feeding troughs full of grain. There's not enough grass here to sustain them. In the past, shepherds would have wandered around to find better grazing, but now the UN says Israel limits their movements. Hamid Kawesme is from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Given the fact that this is a closed military area, their movement, in order for them to go from one place to the other looking for water and looking for grass for their animals, have been largely restricted. You will find a lot of Israeli patrols, Hummers and Jeeps and what have you, coming in all the time and trying to restrict as much as possible any movement of Palestinians. And given the fact that these guys are Bedouins, which depend to go from one place to the other, that affected directly their livelihood.
These days, former grazing land is used by the Israeli army for training. The army says most of the land doesn't belong to the shepherds, and the restrictions on movement are for their safety. Back at Muhammad Abu Ali's cave, tea's being prepared. In the corner, his baby grandson, Jihad, lies cradled in his mother's arms. It isn't clear if he'll be a shepherd like his ancestors or if this ancient way of life is slowly coming to an end.
Bethany Bell there, and there's an online version of that report, complete with pictures of the shepherds and their flocks at bbcnews.com. Just click on the Middle East tab. And we're always anxious to hear your views on opinions expressed, issues raised in the course of the programme. Email address, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. That's it, though, from this edition of Europe Today. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Join us Christmas Day at 12:04 p.m. for Professor Paul Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol. For years, the live reading at the auditorium was a traditional part of the pre-holiday scene for students and faculty at the university. The tradition lives on at AM 580, where we broadcast this recording every year. Sit back and enjoy Professor Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol, Friday afternoon at 12:04, following NPR News.
Today's weather, rain and wind, heavy rain at times, a high 43, east winds at 20 to 25 miles an hour, gusts to around 35. Rainy and windy tonight, heavy rain at times in the evening, near steady temperatures around 40 with east winds at 20 to 25, gusts to around 40. Christmas Day, cloudy, still windy with a chance of rain or snow in the morning and a high of 38 degrees, gusts to around 35 miles an hour. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.